In partial extenuation, because of unusual atmospheric and topographical factors reminiscent of Grant's experience with the ill wind at Iuka, the clatter of musketry did not carry far today, so that in this respect, the 6-mile-long scene of action, or non-action, was compartmented, each sector being sealed off from the others as if by sound-proof walls. One Union staff officer, riding the field, later made the incredible statement that, at one bound, my horse carried me from stillness into the uproar of battle. Partially, too, this explained the lack of overall control which should have remedied the drawback of temporary deafness. Buell, nursing yesterday's bruises back at headquarters, not only did not know what had hit him today, it was after 4 o'clock before he even knew he had been struck. By that time the battle was more than 2 hours old, and the Confederates, too, had been thrown into considerable confusion. This was accomplished partly by Sheridan's gunners, bowling shells across the narrow valley to crush the flank of the advancing files, toppling men like tenpins, including Pat Claiborne, who had recovered from the face wound he had suffered at Richmond, in time to receive a leg wound here when his horse was shot from under him by one of the fast-firing guns across the way, and partly by the disorganization incident to the rapid advance itself. Units had intermingled, not only gray and gray, but also blue and gray, as some stood fast and others retreated. On both sides there was much anguished crying of, "Friends, you are firing into friends!" However, this too was not without its advantages to the attackers, particularly in one instance. When the commander of one of the brigades Gilbert had sent to reinforce McCook approached an imposing-looking officer to ask for instructions as to the posting of his troops, "I have come to your assistance with my brigade," the Federal shouted above the uproar. The gentleman calmly sitting his horse in the midst of carnage turned out to be Polk, who was wearing a dark gray uniform. Polk asked the designation of the newly arrived command, and upon being told, raised his eyebrows in surprise. For all his churchly faith in miracles, he could scarcely believe his ears. "There must be some mistake about this," he said. "You are my prisoner." Fighting without its commander, the brigade gave an excellent account of itself. Joined presently by the other brigade sent over from the center, it did much to stiffen the resistance being offered by the remnants of McCook's 2 divisions. Sundown came before the rebels could complete the rout begun 4 hours ago, and now in the dusk it was Polk's turn to play a befuddled role in another comic incident of confused identity. He saw in the fading light a body of men whom he took to be Confederates firing obliquely into the flank of one of his engaged brigades. "Dear me," he said to himself, "this is very sad and must be stopped." None of his staff being with him at the time, he rode over to attend to the matter in person. When he came up to the erring commander and demanded in angry tones what he meant by shooting his own friends, the colonel replied with surprise, "I don't think there can be any mistake about it. I'm sure they are the enemy." "Enemy?" Polk exclaimed, taken aback by this apparent insubordination. "Why, I have only just left them myself. Cease firing, sir. What is your name, sir?" "Colonel Shryock of the 87th Indiana," the Federal said. "And pray, sir, who are you?" The Bishop General, learning thus for the first time that the man was a Yankee and that he was in rear of a whole regiment of Yankees, determined to brazen out the situation by taking further advantage of the fact that his dark gray blouse looked blue-black in the twilight. He rode closer and shook his fist in the colonel's face, shouting angrily, "I'll soon show you who I am, sir. Cease firing, sir, at once." Then he turned his horse and, calling in an authoritative manner for the bluecoats to cease firing, slowly rode back toward his own lines. He was afraid to ride fast, he later explained, because haste might give his identity away. "Yet at the same time I experienced a disagreeable sensation, like screwing up my back, and calculated how many bullets would be between my shoulders every moment." Screened at last by a small copse, he put the spurs to his horse and galloped back to the proper side of the irregular firing line. But the fighting was practically over by now. Two of his brigades had been withdrawn to meet Gilbert's threat to the left rear, ending all chance for a farther advance, even if Bragg had been willing to risk a night engagement. Presently, even the guns east and west of Perryville ceased their high-angle quarrel across the rooftops. Buell had fought his first battle and fought it badly, having been assaulted and outdone by an army less than a third the size of his own. More than 7,600 men had fallen. 4,211 Federals, 3,396 Confederates. The former had had 845 killed, 2,851 wounded, and 515 captured or missing, while the latter had lost 510, 2,635, and 251 in those same categories. Buell consoled himself for this disparity by predicting that the conflict would stand conspicuous for its severity in the history of the rebellion. Bragg agreed, later reporting that, for the time engaged, it was the severest and most desperately contested engagement within my knowledge. The moon being only just past the full, the night was nearly as bright as day, and there were those in the Union Army who were in favor of launching an immediate full-scale counterattack. Buell himself had tried to get such a movement underway on the right as soon as he discovered he had a battle on his hands, but the messenger, who set out at 4:15 with a verbal order for Thomas to have Crittenden move forward, got lost in the tricky bottoms of Doctor's Creek and did not find him till past sunset. Thomas, who was convinced that the rebels were in heavy strength to his front, sent back word that it was too late for an attack today, but that he would advance in the morning with the first sound of action on the left. Dissatisfied with this dependence on his shattered left, which he knew was in no condition for more fighting, Buell replied that Thomas was to tell Crittenden to press his command forward as much as possible tonight and be prepared to attack at daylight in the morning. The Virginian then rode back to Army headquarters, where Buell repeated these instructions after midnight. Thomas passed them along to Crittenden at 1:30. Have your different divisions ready to attack at daylight. Issue orders at once. Crittenden replied, I am all ready. My post will be to the rear of the center of the line. Morning came, October 9th, but with it there came to headquarters no sound of conflict on the right. Buell waited, then waited some more. At 8 o'clock, 3 hours past dawn, he had his chief of staff send Crittenden the message, Have you commenced the advance? What delays your attack? Crittenden replied that he had received no orders to attack. He had been told, rather, to have his troops ready to attack, and that was precisely what he had done. If they wanted him to go forward, let them say so. Exasperated, Buell told him to get moving, and he did. But Bragg was gone. The Confederates had pulled out after midnight. Convinced at last that he had most of Buell's army to his front, and moreover having accomplished what he had intended when he told Polk to rout him and thus gain time for a concentration to the east, Bragg ordered a prompt junction with Kirby Smith, whom he instructed to move forward from Versailles to Harrodsburg for that purpose. 2 miles short of the latter place, having crossed the Salt and burned the bridges behind him, Polk halted and formed a line of battle in the rain, the long drought apparently having been broken by the booming of heavy guns the day before. Receiving word from Wheeler, who had charge of the rearguard cavalry, that the Federals had not ventured beyond Perryville today, Polk rode with Chaplain C. T. Quintard, afterwards a bishop like himself, to an Episcopal church in Harrodsburg, where the Tennessee chaplain donned his surplice and stole, and entered the sanctuary. While Polk knelt at the altar, Quintard read the litany and pronounced the benediction, accompanied by the murmur of rain against the stained glass windows. Overcome by emotion as he contrasted the peace of the present interlude with what he had seen yesterday in one of the great battles of that fratricidal war, the gray-clad bishop bowed his head and wept. Kirby Smith arrived next morning, several hours before Buell at last came up. Bragg now had all his available troops consolidated, and that night the two armies lay face to face outside the town, each waiting to see what the other was going to do. 50,000 effectives was Buell's estimate of the Confederate strength, and though he himself had 60,000, including Sill, who had promised to join him without fail tomorrow, I think, he could not forget that Bragg, with less than a third his present number of men, had wrecked one wing of the Federal Army when it had been nearly as large as it was now. So Buell did nothing, waiting for Bragg to show his hand, and Bragg did nothing either. "For God's sake, General," Smith exclaimed, "let us fight Buell here." "I will do it, sir," Bragg replied. But he did not. Whatever it was that had come over him 3 weeks ago at Munfordville, when he stood aside while Buell passed around his flank and on to Louisville, came over him again. What was more, disheartening news from North Mississippi informed him that Van Dorn and Price had failed at Corinth, just as Lee had failed in Maryland. Bragg's was the only one of the three intended invasion barbs still stuck in the enemy's hide. Besides, unable to see that he had much to gain from a victory, whereas a defeat might cost him not only the bountiful supply of goods and foodstuffs he had collected, but also his army, he had already decided to withdraw. As he put it in the letter to his wife, "With the whole Southwest thus in the enemy's possession, my crime would have been unpardonable had I kept my noble little army to be icebound in a northern clime, without tents or shoes, and obliged to forage daily for bread, etc." Evincing what one observer called a perplexity and vacillation which had now become simply appalling to Smith, to Hardee, and to Polk, Bragg ordered a retreat toward Bryantsville that night. At dawn, when Buell found the Southern Army gone again, he could scarcely believe that it was not maneuvering for a better position in which to fight the battle which he, and indeed practically everyone else in both armies except Bragg, believed was about to be fought. He followed warily through Harrodsburg, waiting for Bragg to make a stand or else come flailing back at him, guns booming. Beyond Dick's River, the Confederates again formed line of battle near Camp Dick Robinson, but Buell once more found the position too strong for him to risk attacking it. For a full day, Bragg stayed there. Then on the following day, October 13th, when Buell sidled around toward the south, threatening his line of retreat, he got underway in earnest for Cumberland Gap. As long ago as September 29th, anticipating withdrawal from Kentucky 10 days before the Battle of Perryville, he had ordered 100,000 rations collected there, as well as another 200,000 at London, halfway between the present position of his army and the Gap. The retreat, though Bragg did not call it that, he called it a withdrawal, the successful completion of a giant raid, was in two columns, Polk and Hardee marching by way of Lancaster and Crab Orchard, Kirby Smith by way of Big Hill, accompanying the heavy-laden trains. It was, as a later observer remarked, a dismal but picturesque affair. Cavalry fanned out front and rear and flankwards to protect the enormous droves of hogs, sheep, and beef cattle, herded by cowboys recruited from Texas regiments. Conspicuous among the motley aggregation of vehicles in the creaking train, which included carriages, omnibuses, and stagecoaches pressed into service to remove the mountain of supplies, were the 400 bright new wagons, each with U.S. stenciled on its canvas, which had been captured nearby from Nelson in late August. Approaching Big Hill from the opposite direction, Smith was feeling none of the elation he had experienced then, with victory still before him, not behind. "My command from loss of sleep for 5 nights is completely exhausted," he reported during the early morning hours of October 14th. "The straggling has been unusually great. The rear of the column will not reach here before daybreak. I have no hope of saving the whole of my train, as I shall be obliged to double teams in going up Big Hill, and will necessarily be delayed there 2 or 3 days." His near despair was based on an overrating of Buell, who he thought would press him hard, and an underrating of his own troops, particularly those in the rear guard under Wheeler. These horsemen fought no less than 26 separate engagements during the first 5 days and nights of the march, one for each year of their youthful colonel's life. beating off federal attempts to hack at the long, slow-moving line of wagons. By dawn of the second day, however, Smith's gloom had deepened. Still at Big Hill, he notified Bragg, "I have little hope of saving any of the train, and fear much of the artillery will be lost." But here again he was unduly pessimistic. While Stevenson's division held a line beyond range of the hill, Heath's men lined the difficult slope from foot to summit, and, as one of them later wrote, when "starved and tired mules faltered and fell, seized the wagons and lifted them by sheer force over the worst places." All day, all night, until noon of the following day, October 16th, the trains in one unbroken stream continued to pour over Big Hill, and then the troops followed. Smith felt considerably better now, having broken into the clear. Even the fact that this was hostile country had its advantages, since it encouraged stragglers to keep up. Beyond Mount Vernon, next day at Big Rock Castle River, he appealed to Polk, who had already crossed, "Cannot we unite and end this disastrous retreat by a glorious victory?" But even if Bragg had been willing, which he was not, it was too late. Hearing from Nashville this same day that a Confederate force was rapidly concentrating against that place, Buell broke contact just beyond London, abandoned the pursuit, and turned west. "I have no apprehension," the Nashville commander had assured him, but Buell more than made up for this lack. He was apprehensive not only for the safety of the Tennessee capital, but also for the safety of his army, which by now had entered the Barrens. He wired Halleck, "The enemy has been driven into the heart of this desert and must go on, for he cannot exist in it. For the same reason, we cannot pursue in it with any hope of overtaking him. For while he is moving back on his supplies, and as he goes consuming what the country affords, we must bring ours forward. I deem it useless and inexpedient to continue the pursuit, but propose to direct the main force under my command rapidly upon Nashville, which General Negley reported to me is already being invested by a considerable force, and toward which I have no doubt Bragg will move the main part of his army." In thus abandoning the pursuit, which in the end might have taken him into East Tennessee, the one region Lincoln most wanted delivered, Buell knew that he was fanning the wrath of his superiors, who had removed him from command once already and had restored him only under political pressure after his successor had declined the post. Anticipating what would follow, he told Halleck, "While I shall proceed with these dispositions, deeming them to be proper for the public interest, it is but meet that I should say that the present time is perhaps as convenient as any for making any change that may be thought proper in the command of this army." And having thus invited his dismissal, he said of the army he had led, "It has not accomplished all that I had hoped or all that faction might demand. Yet, composed as it is, one half of perfectly new troops, it has defeated a powerful and thoroughly disciplined army in one battle, and has driven it away baffled and dispirited at least, and as much demoralized as an army can be under such discipline as Bragg maintains over all troops that he commands." Bragg would have appreciated the closing compliment, dealing as it did with the quality on which he placed the strongest emphasis. But just now he was satisfied with being allowed to continue his withdrawal unmolested. He pressed on through Barberville, leaving Kirby Smith to bring up the rear. That general, much disgusted, formally resumed command of the Department of East Tennessee on October 20th, as soon as he reached Flat Lick, Kentucky. Approaching Cumberland Gap 2 days later, he was astounded and enraged to receive from Bragg, already in Knoxville, orders for him to leave 3,000 men at that strategic point and prepare the remainder for another joint incursion, this time into Middle Tennessee. His troops were worn down, he replied, much in want of shoes, clothing, and blankets, and reduced by straggling to about 6,000 effectives. "Having resumed the command of my department," he added pointedly, "I am directly responsible to the government for the condition and safety of my army." It was, in effect, a bill of divorcement. He wanted no more joint campaigns, not with Bragg at any rate, and doubtless he was relieved to find the North Carolinian gone from Knoxville when he himself arrived October 24th, so weary and discouraged that he slipped into town under cover of darkness in order to avoid a public reception planned in his honor. The main thing he wanted now was rest, which he hoped would enable him to forget the final lap of his 70-day round-trip journey through central Kentucky. No such rousing welcome had been planned for Bragg, whose problem on his return was the avoidance not of praise but of blame amounting to downright condemnation. Though he had never courted or apparently even desired popularity, much preferring to be respected for the sternness of his discipline rather than admired for the warmth of his nature, of which, in truth, he had little, this opprobrium heaped on the shoulders of the man who had conceived and led the most successful offensive so far launched by a Confederate commander outside the strict national limits seemed to him as unfair as it was unrealistic. Where Lee had failed, for example, he, Bragg, had succeeded, not only with a smaller army against longer odds, but with far fewer casualties and far greater material results. Yet Lee was praised and he was blamed. In his final report of the campaign, submitted some months later, though he avoided comparisons, he attempted to refute his critics point by point. Whatever there was of failure or shortcoming, he assigned it to the backwardness of the expected Kentucky volunteers, who by their lack of native patriotism, so he called or thought of it, had forced him to travel the long road back to Tennessee with 20,000 unused muskets in his wagons. Nor was he reticent in summing up his gains. Though compelled to yield to largely superior numbers and fortuitous circumstances a portion of the valuable territory from which we had driven the enemy, the fruits of the campaign were very large and have had a most important bearing upon our subsequent military operations here and elsewhere. With a force enabling us at no time to put more than 40,000 men of all arms and in all places in battle, we had redeemed North Alabama and Middle Tennessee and recovered possession of Cumberland Gap, the gateway to the heart of the Confederacy. We had killed, wounded, and captured no less than 25,000 of the enemy, taken over 30 pieces of artillery, 17,000 small arms, some 2 million cartridges for the same, destroyed some hundreds of wagons and brought off several hundreds more with their teams and harness complete, replaced our jaded horses by a fine mount, lived 2 months upon supplies wrested from the enemy's possession, secured material to clothe the army, and finally secured subsistence from the redeemed country to support not only the army but also a large force of the Confederacy to the present time. Though some of this was actually understated, it made no real impression on his critics. They were not so much concerned with what he had done, which admittedly was considerable, as they were with what he had not done. In fact, their complaints in this respect were so immediately vociferous that on October 23rd, the day after he reached Knoxville, Bragg was summoned to Richmond by a wire from the adjutant general, who informed him, "The president desires that you will lose no time in coming here." Amid rumors that he was about to be relieved, he caught an eastbound train the following morning, thus avoiding a meeting with Kirby Smith, who arrived that night. Whatever weight Davis and Cooper might attach to Bragg's claims in determining whether to sustain or fire him, Lincoln and Halleck apparently were inclined not only to accept them at face value, but also to deduct from them what little credit his opponent had left in their direction. Receiving Buell's dispatch of October 17th, wherein he announced that he was abandoning the pursuit to return to Nashville, the general-in-chief replied next morning, "The great object to be attained is to drive the enemy from Kentucky and East Tennessee. If we cannot do it now, we need never to hope for it." This was followed by another wire in which Halleck brought Lincoln's logic to bear by indirect quotation, reinforcing the protest he had made the day before. "The capture of East Tennessee should be the main object of your campaign. You say it is the heart of the enemy's resources. Make it the heart of yours. Your army can live there if the enemy's can. I am directed by the president to say to you that your army must enter East Tennessee this fall and that it ought to move there while the roads are passable. He does not understand why we cannot march as the enemy marches, live as he lives, and fight as he fights, unless we admit the inferiority of our troops and of our generals. Logic was a knife that could cut both ways, however, and pre-war service in the adjutant general's office had made Buell familiar with its use. He replied October 20th with a long, closely reasoned exegesis on the difficulties of what was being required of him. But that was not what Lincoln and Halleck wanted to hear. Besides, as an indication of his progress, the sequential headings in his telegrams, Mount Vernon, Crab Orchard, Danville, spoke a clearer language than their contents. Despite his former suggestion that the present time is perhaps as convenient as any for making any change that may be thought proper, Buell's military lifeline was running out much faster than he thought. Previously, after being relieved, he had been restored to command partly as a result of political pressure in his favor. But such pressure as was being exerted now was in the opposite direction. His old enemy Governor Morton, for example, was wiring Lincoln, "The butchery of our troops at Perryville was terrible. Nothing but success, speedy and decided, will save our cause from utter destruction. In the Northwest, distrust and despair are seizing upon the hearts of the people." Armed with this, and presently reinforced by similar expressions of displeasure from Yates of Illinois and Todd of Ohio, Halleck told Buell on October 22nd, "It is the wish of the government that your army proceed to and occupy East Tennessee with all possible dispatch. It leaves to you the selection of the roads upon which to move to that object. Neither the government nor the country can endure these repeated delays. Both require a prompt and immediate movement toward the accomplishment of the great object in view, the holding of East Tennessee." Buell now had his orders, the first specific ones he had received. But before he could put them into execution, and on the same day Bragg left Knoxville bound for Richmond, the following was delivered. Washington, October 24th. Major General D.C. Buell commanding, etc. "General, the President directs that on the presentation of this order, you will turn over your command to Major General W.S. Rosecrans and repair to Indianapolis, Indiana, reporting from that place to the Adjutant General of the Army for further orders. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, H.W. Halleck, General-in-Chief." Chapter 8. Last Best Hope of Earth. Buell was not the first, nor was he the last, of the blue-clad puppets whose strings had been cut, or would be cut, in what turned out to be a season of dismissals. Others had been, or were about to be, packed away in their boxes, mute, their occupations gone like Othello's, and themselves removed, like him, from the big wars that make ambition virtue. Halleck, from his position near the vital center, had forecast the political weather at the outset back in August, when he told a friend, "I can hardly describe to you the feeling of disappointment here in the want of activity," and added, "The government seems determined to apply the guillotine to all unsuccessful generals. It seems rather hard to do this where the general is not in fault, but perhaps with us now, as in the French Revolution, some harsh measures are required." The axe was descending. Pope's head rolled before Buell's. McDowell, too, though admittedly he was more sinned against than sinning, was gone, complaining wistfully as he went, "I did not ask to be relieved. I only asked for a court." Even the Navy, barnacle-encrusted during the nearly 50 peacetime years since the War of 1812, had stretched some necks beneath the blade. Down on the Gulf, glad to be breathing salt air after the Vicksburg, Arkansas fiasco, Farragut gave his late summer and early fall attention to the Texas coast, where the blockaders worked without the advantage of a lodgment on the mainland. With this in mind, he sent out three expeditions in as many months. The first attacked Corpus Christi in mid-August, but, having no occupation troops, withdrew after giving the place a pounding. Next month, the second expedition went up Sabine Pass, wrecked the railroad bridge and the fort at Sabine City, captured a pair of rebel steamers, and retired again to the bay. The third was more ambitious, being aimed at Galveston. It was also more successful. Two regular gunboats and two converted ferries hit the port on October 5th, drove the Confederates out with a few well-aimed salvos, then landed a token force of 260 men commanded by a colonel. After which, by a tacit understanding, the warships patrolling the bay refrained from further shelling on condition that the rebels would not move artillery into Galveston over the two-mile-long bridge connecting the island town with the mainland. Alabama was now the only southern state with an unoccupied coast, and Farragut had redeemed, at least in part, his midsummer performance up the Mississippi. Gratifying as this redemption was to Secretary Welles, whom Lincoln dubbed Father Neptune and sometimes Noah, it also called attention to the contrast between the Tennessee sailor's makeup and that of his former upriver partner, the Boston Brahmin Charles H. Davis, who had run into little but trouble since he replaced Foote as flotilla commander on the upper Mississippi back in May. He was, as one of his officers said, a most charming and lovable man, author of two esoteric books and a member of the commission which had planned the strikes at Hatteras and Port Royal. But it was becoming increasingly apparent that he lacked what Farragut had and what Foote had had before him. A hard-driving, bulldog, cut-and-slash aggressiveness, a preference for action at close quarters, and a burning sense of personal insult at the slightest advantage gained by an opponent at his expense. Since it was this quality or combination of qualities which would be needed for the work that lay ahead on the Big River, Welles decided Captain Davis had to go. In mid-October he acted. Davis was eased upstairs to the Bureau of Navigation, where he would find work better suited to his intellectual capacities. There was little that was surprising in this removal. What was surprising was the Secretary's choice of a successor, David Dixon Porter. Porter was only a junior commander, so that to give him the job, Welles had to disappoint and outrage more than 80 senior officers. Besides, there were personal drawbacks. Like his brother, Dirty Bill, Porter was not above claiming other men's glory as his own. He would stretch or varnish the truth to serve his purpose. He would undermine a superior. He would promise a good deal more than he could deliver, all of which he had done at New Orleans, and then had gone on to do them again at Vicksburg. Yet he had virtues, too, of the sort which Othello said proceeded from ambition in the big wars. Like Lincoln in his pre-Manassas judgment of John Pope, Welles apparently believed that a liar might yet be brave and have skill as an officer. Weighing the virtues against the vices, the gray-bearded, brown-wigged naval head confided in his diary, "Porter is but a commander. He has, however, stirring and positive qualities, is fertile in resources, has great energy, excessive and sometimes not over-scrupulous ambition, is impressed with and boastful of his own powers, given to exaggeration in relation to himself, a Porter infirmity, is not generous to older and superior living officers whom he is too ready to traduce, but is kind and patronizing to favorites who are juniors, is given to cliqueism, but is brave and daring like all his family. He has not the conscientious and high moral qualities of Foote to organize the flotilla, and is not considered by some of our best naval men a fortunate officer. His selection will be unsatisfactory to many, but his field of operations is peculiar, and a young and active officer is required for the duty to which he is assigned." Having decided that the credits overbalanced the debits, in weight if not in number, Welles called Porter into his office and informed him that he was being sent as an acting rear admiral to take charge of the Navy on the Western waters. The order was dated October 9th. Porter, who had come north on leave, hoping to cure a touch of fever he had contracted in the region to which his chief was now returning him, accepted both the assignment and the promotion as no more than his due. 6 days later, he was in Cairo, where he assumed command of the 125 vessels comprising the Mississippi Squadron, together with 1,300 officers, only 25 of whom had been in the old Navy, and approximately 10,000 sailors. What he would do with these boats and officers and men, and whether Wells would be sustained by circumstance in his choice of a man whose character he doubted, remained to be seen. At any rate, Buell and Davis had been brought down, and now, as October wore toward a close, giving occasion in the East for a mocking revival of All Quiet Along the Potomac, Lincoln was after larger game. In fact, he was after the top-ranking man in the whole U.S. Army, George B. McClellan. The other two had been wing shots, targets of opportunity, so to speak, but this one he was stalking with care, intending to catch him on the sit. According to some observers, this should not be difficult, since that was the young Napoleon's accustomed attitude. The managing editor of the New York Tribune, for example, had written privately in late September, a week after the Battle of Antietam, that one of his reporters had just returned from the army, and his notion is that it is to be quiet along the Potomac for some time to come. George, whom Providence helps according to his nature, has got himself on one side of a ditch, which Providence had already made for him, with the enemy on the other, and has no idea of moving. Woodenhead at Washington will never think of sending a force through the mountains to attack Lee in the rear. So the two armies will watch each other for nobody knows how many weeks, and we shall have the poetry of war with pickets drinking from the same stream, holding friendly converse, and sending newspapers across by various ingenious contrivances. In other words, this Indian summer, with its firm roads and its fair skies tinged with wood smoke, was to be wasted militarily, like the last one, in getting ready for a movement which bad weather would postpone. Whether the country would stand for another such winter of apparent inactivity, Lincoln did not know, but he himself could not, nor did he intend to. On the first day of October, without sending word that he was coming, he boarded a train and rode out to Western Maryland to see the general and his army. McClellan, however, got word that he was on the way and met him at Harper's Ferry. Pleased to find that the president had brought no politicians with him, merely some Western officers, McClellan wrote his wife, "His ostensible purpose is to see the troops and the battlefield. I incline to think that the real purpose of his visit is to push me into a premature advance into Virginia. I may be mistaken, but think not." He was not mistaken. That was precisely why Lincoln had come. "I went up to the field to try to get McClellan to move," he said later. But as usual, when he was face to face with Little Mac discussing military matters, he got nowhere. Apparently he did not really try very hard. The primary inertia was too great. When he urged an advance, McClellan went into an explanation of shortages and drawbacks, and Lincoln dropped the subject. According to the general, "He more than once assured me that he was fully satisfied with my whole course from the beginning, that the only fault he could possibly find was that I was perhaps too prone to be sure that everything was ready before acting, but that my actions were all right when I started." Later, they sat on a hillside, Lincoln with his long legs drawn up so that his knees were almost under his chin, and McClellan afterwards wrote that Lincoln told him, "General, you have saved the country. You must remain in command and carry us through to the end." When McClellan said that this would be impossible, "The influences at Washington will be too strong for you, Mr. President. I will not be allowed the required time for preparation." Lincoln replied, "General, I pledge myself to stand between you and harm." It was a 3-day visit, and much of the time was spent reviewing the troops. The president looked pale, according to one veteran who saw him, while another remarked that as he rode around every battalion, he seemed much worn and distressed and to be looking for those who were gone. Doubtless he was thinking of the fallen, but he was also thinking of the men he saw, and of what they represented. A Union surgeon noted that Lincoln was well-received by the soldiers, but by no means so enthusiastically as General McClellan. Lincoln did not mind this much. What he minded was the thought that this gave rise to. "The Army of the Potomac is my army as much as any army ever belonged to the man that created it," McClellan told a member of his staff about this time. "We have grown together and fought together. We are wedded and should not be separated." The army felt that way too, and Lincoln knew it. He also knew that if the soldiers felt it strongly enough, mutiny would follow any order for the general's removal from command. This was much on his mind during the visit and resulted in a curious scene. Just before dawn of the second morning, he woke O.M. Hatch, an Illinois friend. "Come, Hatch," he said, "I want you to take a walk with me." Together they climbed to a hilltop overlooking the camps, and as sunrise lighted the valley where the troops lay waiting for reveille, Lincoln made an abstracted gesture, indicating the tented plain below. "Hatch, Hatch," he said in a husky voice, barely above a whisper. "What is all this?" His companion was confused. "Why, Mr. Lincoln, this is the Army of the Potomac," he replied. Lincoln shook his head. "No, Hatch, no. This is General McClellan's bodyguard." He returned to Washington October 4th. 2 days later, Halleck astonished McClellan with a telegraphic dispatch. "The president directs that you cross the Potomac and give battle to the enemy or drive him south. Your army must move now while the roads are good. I am directed to add that the Secretary of War and the General-in-Chief concur with the President in these instructions." McClellan replied that he was pushing everything as rapidly as possible in order to get ready for the advance. Beyond this bare acknowledgement, however, the only sign he gave that he had received the directive was a step up in the submission of requisitions for more supplies of every description. He wanted shoes, hospital tents, and horses. Especially horses, the need for which was presently emphasized by Jeb Stuart, who once more covered himself with glory at the young Napoleon's expense. Under instructions from Lee to scout the federal dispositions, and if possible destroy the railroad bridge over the Conococheague near Chambersburg, which would limit McClellan's rail supply facilities to the B&O, Stuart crossed the Potomac above Martinsburg at early dawn October 10th. He had with him 1,800 horsemen and 4 guns. By noon he was across the Pennsylvania line, approaching Mercersburg. Soon after dark the lights of Chambersburg were in view. Demanding and receiving the surrender of the place, he appointed Wade Hampton military governor, quite as if he intended to stay there all fall, and bivouacked that night in the streets of the town. There were 2 disappointments. A bank official had escaped with all the cash in the vault, and the Conococheague Bridge, being built of iron, proved indestructible. However, there were material compensations, including the capture and parole of 280 bluecoats, the opportunity to spend Confederate money in well-stocked Pennsylvania stores, and the impressment of more than 1,000 excellent horses. Many of these last were draft animals of Norman and Belgian stock, and it was fortunate that they were seized in harness, since no southern quartermaster could furnish collars large enough for the big-necked creatures soon to be hauling rebel guns and wagons. Their former owners, never having seen an actual secessionist, were under the impression that Stuart's troopers were federal soldiers sent to harass farmers suspected of disloyalty, and many of them protested indignantly as the raiders led their heavy-footed animals away. "I'm just as good a Union man as any of you." Jeb's men had come nearly 40 miles to reach their assigned objective, stirring up a hive of enemy cavalry in the process, and now the problem was how to get them back. Stuart met it as he had done before. When the column formed outside Chambersburg next morning, he led it, not southwest in the direction he had come from, but due east. Though he would have to ride more than twice as far to reach the Potomac by this route, it gave him the advantage of being unexpected along the way. The gray jackets whooped at this evidence that they were about to repeat their peninsula performance by staging another ride around McClellan. Eastward they rode beyond the Blue Ridge, on through Cashtown, where they stopped to feed the horses, then turned south, avoiding the college town of Gettysburg, 8 miles off. Late that afternoon they recrossed the Pennsylvania line and entered Emmitsburg, beyond which, riding in darkness now and frequently changing to captured horses to spare their own, they forded the Monocacy. Some fought sleep by dismounting to walk a mile or so from time to time. Others slumped in their saddles and frankly slept, their snores droning loud above the hoofclops. Word of the raid had spread to Washington by now. "Not a man should be permitted to return to Virginia," Halleck wired McClellan, who replied, "I have given every order necessary to ensure the capture or destruction of those forces, and I hope we may be able to teach them a lesson they will not soon forget." But that was not to be. Sunday morning, October 12th, near the mouth of the Monocacy, where Lee had crossed with his whole army marching north the month before, Stuart broke through a weak link in the cordon, splashed across the Potomac, and regained the safety of the Confederate lines. He had 2 men missing, victims most likely of commandeered Yankee whiskey, and a handful slightly wounded. That seemed to him a small price to pay for the nearly 300 bluecoats paroled at Chambersburg and the 30-odd public officials brought back as hostages to secure the release or considerate treatment of Southerners now in Union hands. More than $250,000 in public and railroad property had been destroyed, and in exchange for about 60 lame or worn-out animals abandoned along the way, the gray troopers had brought 1,200 horses back from Pennsylvania for service under the Stars and Bars. Most satisfactory of all, at least to Stuart, who thus once more had justified his plume, was the knowledge that all this had been accomplished in the immediate presence of more than 100,000 enemy soldiers, whose commander, midway through the raid, had announced his intention to teach the rebels a lesson by effecting their capture or destruction. Instead, it was McClellan who had been taught a lesson, though whether he would profit from it was doubtful. Apparently, he had failed to absorb much from the same lesson when it was first administered 4 months ago on the peninsula. Now, as then, he was the object of much derision, north and south. Only this time, Lincoln himself led the chorus. He was aboard a steamer, returning from a troop review at Alexandria, when someone asked him, "Mr. President, what about McClellan?" Without looking up, Lincoln drew a circle on the deck with the ferrule of his umbrella. "When I was a boy, we used to play a game," he said, "3 times round and out. Stuart has been round him twice. If he goes around him once more, gentlemen, McClellan will be out." A new and biting note of mockery was coming into the president's references to the commander of the Army of the Potomac. Formerly, this had been restricted mainly to comments on Little Mac's political suggestions, as when the governor of Massachusetts asked what Lincoln was going to reply to some advice McClellan had offered on a civil matter. "Nothing," Lincoln said, "but it made me think of the man whose horse kicked up and stuck his foot through the stirrup. He said to the horse, 'If you are going to get on, I'll get off.'" Thus he had dealt with McClellan the would-be statesman, reserving his respect for McClellan the soldier. Now this, too, was fading. On the day after Stuart got back from his raid, Lincoln sent the circumnavigated young Napoleon a long letter full of advice, in effect a lecture on strategy and tactics. "You remember my speaking to you of what I called your overcautiousness. Are you not overcautious when you assume that you cannot do what the enemy is constantly doing? Should you not claim to be at least his equal in prowess and act upon the claim? Exclusive of the water line, you are now nearer Richmond than the enemy is by the route you can and he must take. Why can you not reach there before him, unless you admit that he is more than your equal on the march? I would press closely to him, fight him if a favorable opportunity should present, and at least try to beat him to Richmond on the inside track. I say try. If we never try, we shall never succeed." That was the main thing, as Lincoln saw it. Beat him, A stalemate would not serve. Even a repulse was not enough. We should not so operate as to merely drive him away. As we must beat him somewhere or fail finally, we can do it, if at all, easier near to us than far away. If we cannot beat the enemy where he now is, we never can, he being again within the entrenchments of Richmond. It is all easy if our troops march as well as the enemy, and it is unmanly to say they cannot do it. He added, "This letter is in no sense an order." Thus Lincoln. But McClellan apparently had as little respect for Lincoln the would-be strategist as Lincoln had for McClellan the would-be statesman. October's perfect weather went sliding by, and the army hugged its camps while its commander, despite his own chief quartermaster's protest that no army was ever more perfectly supplied than this one has been as a general rule, continued to call for more and more supplies. He also wanted more soldiers, believing himself outnumbered, though his strength report of October 20th listed 133,433 men present for duty, with an aggregate present of 159,860. Next day, Halleck wired him, "Telegraph when you will move and on what lines you propose to march." McClellan replied that he was nearly ready, but when he followed this with an urgent request for more horses, claiming that the ones he had were broken down by arduous service and weakened by foot-and-mouth disease, Lincoln lost his temper. "I have just read your dispatch about sore-tongued and fatigued horses," he wired on October 25th. "Will you pardon me for asking what the horses of your army have done since the Battle of Antietam that fatigues anything?" McClellan was upset. "It was one of those little flings that I can't get used to when they are not merited," he wrote his wife, and he protested at some length to Lincoln the following day, defending his troopers and announcing that the long-awaited movement of his army across the Potomac had begun. Mollified, the president replied that he had intended no injustice to any, and if I have done any, I deeply regret it. To be told, after more than 5 weeks' total inaction of the army, that the cavalry horses were too much fatigued to move, presents a cheerless, almost hopeless prospect for the future, and it may have forced something of impatience in my dispatch. McClellan had an apology, such as it was, yet his gloom was unrelieved. Through it he saw plainly what was coming. When one of his corps commanders indicated a spot on the map where he thought the next great battle would be fought, he nodded agreement, but added sadly, "I may not have command of the army much longer. Lincoln is down on me." Lincoln was indeed down on him, though he wired that he was "glad to believe you are crossing." Privately, he was saying that he was tired of trying to bore with an auger too dull to take hold. However, he had a final secret test in mind. Lee's army, drawn up around Winchester, was farther from Richmond than McClellan's, which was crossing the Potomac below Harper's Ferry. "His route is the arc of a circle, while yours is the chord," Lincoln had said in the tactics lecture 2 weeks before. If, in spite of this disadvantage, the Confederate commander managed to interpose his troops between the advancing Federals and his capital, McClellan would be out. So Lincoln decided and kept his decision to himself, watching and waiting. He waited long. It took the Blue Host 9 days to cross the river and begin its southward creep, east of the Blue Ridge, toward a concentration around Warrenton. By that time Lee, unmolested, had shifted half his army to Culpeper, squarely across the Federal line of march. McClellan had failed the test, and Lincoln's mind was made up. He would remove him. Fearing that this was about to happen, old Francis Blair pled against it with all the persuasion learned in a lifetime spent advising presidents. McClellan was the Union's one best hope for preservation, he declared. Lincoln disagreed. "I said I would remove him if he let Lee's army get away from him, and I must do so." "He has got the slows, Mr. Blair." He would remove him, but not just yet. November 4th was the first Tuesday in the month, which meant that it was election day in most of the northern states, and therefore not a propitious time for disturbing voters who were disturbed enough already. Even Chase, who vied with Stanton in the intensity of his desire to see McClellan ousted, admitted privately that it was inexpedient to fire the general on the eve of the congressional elections, lest the administration's motives be misconstrued as a sop to the radicals. There was a widespread conviction among conservatives that the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation had been sop enough in that direction. Political unrest found its basis there, together with objection to arbitrary arrests and the general lack of satisfaction with the prosecution of the war itself, which seemed to have stalled on every front. Nor was this dissatisfaction limited to moderates and conservatives. Iowa Senator J.W. Grimes, a loyal Republican whose constituents had voted heavily for Lincoln in 1860, was saying flatly, "We are going to destruction as fast as imbecility, corruption, and the wheels of time can carry us." Lyman Trumbull of Lincoln's home state was complaining bitterly of a lack of affirmative, positive action and business talent in the cabinet, while to Governor Andrew of Massachusetts it seemed that the president has never yet seemed quite sure that we are in a war at all. Such remarks were straws in the wind down which Democrats sniffed victory in November, and in many instances they got it. New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, all of which had gone solidly Republican in the election held 2 years ago, sent Democratic delegations to the House of Representatives. So did Illinois, where Lincoln's good friend Leonard Swett went down in defeat to John T. Stewart, the president's former law partner, who thus made one among the 9 Democrats elected as opposed to 5 Republicans. New Jersey, which had split its vote before, now went solidly Democratic. Wisconsin, on the other hand, now split her 6-man delegation down the middle. Although the number of Democratic congressmen increased from 44 to 75 as a result of this election, the Republicans would remain the majority party because they managed to carry 3 widely scattered regions: New England, the border states, and the Far West. Such comfort as Lincoln found in this was considerably soured, however, by the fact that most observers saw in the individual defeats a rebuke of the party leader and a rejection of his policies on the conduct of the war. The friendly New York Times ran the election story under the heading "Vote of Want of Confidence," and in Lincoln's own home state the Salem Advocate declared, "We saw the President of the United States stretching forth his hand and seizing the reins of government with almost absolute power, and yet the people submitted. On the 4th day of November, 1862, the people arose in their might, they uttered their voice like the sound of many waters, and tyranny, corruption, and maladministration trembled." Lincoln took it philosophically, though he found it hard to do so, remarking that he felt like the boy who stubbed his toe on the way to see his girl. He was too big to cry, he said, and it hurt too much to laugh. One thing it did, at any rate, however it came out, it cleared the way for action on McClellan. November 5th, before the election tabulations were complete, Lincoln had the orders for his removal drawn up. The following evening they were given to Brigadier General C.P. Buckingham, the so-called confidential assistant adjutant general to the Secretary of War, who left with them next morning, November 7th, aboard a special train bound for McClellan's headquarters at Rectortown, near Manassas Gap. The first snowfall of winter was whitening the North Virginia landscape, and the car in which he rode was drafty, but Buckingham did not wonder that an officer with so much rank as his was being exposed to such discomfort, and employed as a sort of overdressed messenger boy, Stanton having explained that McClellan might refuse to relinquish command of his army if the order was presented to him by a man with anything less than stars on his shoulders. Even with them, the secretary had added darkly, there was a strong possibility of some such mutinous action on the part of the commander of the Army of the Potomac. He advised the brigadier to make his arrival unannounced, thus gaining the military advantage of a surprise attack. It was still snowing at 11 o'clock that night. McClellan sat alone in his tent, ending the day as usual with a letter to his wife, who was busy getting settled in their new home at Trenton, New Jersey. Nothing in his manner showed that the proposed surprise had failed, but it had. He knew that Buckingham had arrived early that evening, and he knew what his arrival probably meant. Whatever there was of real surprise lay in the fact that instead of coming directly from the depot to Army headquarters here at Rectortown, the War Department emissary had ridden down to Salem, 5 miles south, where Burnside's corps was posted. Presently, however, this too was explained. A knock came at the tent pole, and when McClellan looked up from his letter, calling for whoever it was to enter, the canvas flap lifted, and there stood Buckingham and Burnside, snow collected on the crowns and brims of their hats and sifted into the folds of their greatcoats. Behind his facial ruff of dark brown whiskers, also lightly powdered with snow so that it resembled a badly printed trademark, dear Byrne looked both embarrassed and distressed. McClellan knew what that meant, too, but for the present he gave no sign of this. He invited the visitors in, quite as if for an informal midnight chat, and for a time he and Buckingham exchanged pleasantries, Burnside sitting glumly by, looking rather as if he had been struck a hard blow on the head. Finally, though, the staff brigadier remarked that he had come to deliver some papers, and with that he passed them over. There were two of them, both dated November 5th. Lincoln, having authorized Halleck, in his discretion, to issue an order removing McClellan forthwith, or so soon as he may deem proper, the general-in-chief had deemed it proper to act without delay. Major General McClellan, commanding, etc. General, on receipt of the order of the President sent herewith, you will immediately turn over your command to Major General Burnside and repair to Trenton, New Jersey, reporting on your arrival at that place by telegraph for further orders. Very respectfully, your obedient servant. The second was from the Adjutant General's office and was a direct quotation of the first sentence of Lincoln's message to Halleck. By direction of the President of the United States, it is ordered that Major General